طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where this morning the Palestinian voice you will hear is that of old friend Mazen Kumsia, speaking at the Community Church of Boston. Mazen has a doctorate in biology and taught at both Duke and Yale universities, but is back in Palestine at Bethlehem University, where he has founded the Palestine Natural History Museum. Mazen came to Cambridge to speak at the annual Science for Palestine conference at MIT. Most of us know Mazen as an activist, but he's a passionate scientist who sees the intersectionality between science, climate change, and social justice. Here is Mazen Kumsia speaking at the Community Church in Boston.
Thank you very much. I have actually come here about 2.5 years ago, I guess. I spoke at this church in 2017. And at the time, I started by complaining. And I was complaining about the harassment I was receiving at the airports. Those of you who are here remember this. And I resolved, after a trip in the U.S., which involved basically 5 states, like 20 cities where I had speeches, but at every airport I was being harassed for hours and hours. So I resolved to resolve this issue, and I was looking for some support, and I was looking to lawyers, ACLU and other places, and then Shana, daughter of our hosts here, she emailed me. She said, well, I know this group at CUNY, City University of New York, a program called CLEAR, which is a nice name, abbreviation for something long. But anyway, supposed to clear you. So I said, that sounds great. So she networked me with them, and I wrote to them, and they took on my case 2.5 years ago. And the way the case progressed is very interesting, because I went after the government first with the so-called Freedom of Information Act, if you know about it, that you're supposed to, your government is supposed to give you information. So they, the first information they sent her was, they sent the team there, was about a 2-page document which said nothing, basically, and so they wrote another letter, another Freedom of Information Act. Things got to go from Homeland Security to FBI to all sorts of other things. The last document they got was 500 pages from the FBI. 500 pages. Unfortunately, most of the 500 pages were redacted, meaning that they were black. And with footnotes explaining why they were black, because they are supposed not to reveal the sources, which I know what the sources are, of course, is the Israeli government tells them what their, my activities over there, and they write it down in their reports, you know, and whatever Israel tells them, since this is also, as you know, Israeli-occupied territory. I don't know if you guys know this. We're not the only people who are occupied. But anyways, so in total, actually, if I gathered all the words in those 500 pages and put them in one block of text, it would be about 2.5 pages. But there is enough insight in there to see how they think, for example, about the fact that I was on the Gaza boat to Gaza, or the support for ISM, or other things which are obvious, or BDS, for example, boycott, divestment, sanctions. But anyway, I don't want to belabor this point, but the case is still ongoing. They are still going after the government. And so I told them I'm coming to the U.S. again to be in this program called Scientists for Palestine. And they said, sure, and they provided me with a letter in case I get harassed and phone numbers and all of this stuff. I had them on my WhatsApp throughout the process of coming into Boston Airport and all of this stuff. And but I was surprised. Nobody asked me a question. Zipped me right through. So whatever they did with this harassment of the government seemed to work. So I guess I'm no longer on that black list because nobody asked me any question, not at the airport in, you know, Frankfurt or Amman or here, usually, or even the airports outside. So I'm very grateful, and so I'll be coming more to the U.S., I suppose. But anyway, 2020 vision, you know, but actually the middle of this is not quite 2020. There's fuzziness in there. But that's a metaphor for our life. Is sometimes it's sharp on the edges, fuzzy in the middle, sometimes the other way around. We don't know where we are going. And those of you who have come here expecting me to have all the answers in 2020 visions will be very disappointed. Because I don't have a lot of the answers. I mean, I have some ideas for some things, and I hope that we will have a kind of an interesting conversation because I'm, you know, I just want to tell you that this meeting called Scientists for Palestine, I presented about 10 minutes. I allowed us only 10 minutes to present. So I presented some ideas about how we can conduct science under occupation in Palestine successfully, and we have done it successfully. But, you know, science is a very interesting thing. Science can be used for all sorts of things, you know, good things and bad things. There's the science of now drones, for example, where they can, you know, like these Israeli or American operators of drones, they sit thousands of miles away and they can drive, you know, this $64 or $100 million airplane that shoots somebody or at a refugee camp or somewhere and blows up, you know, thousands of people. And the person doing it is like a video game. That's science, of course, GPS and all this stuff. Nuclear weapons, you know, nuclear weapons, as you know, people don't pay attention, but the U.S. actually withdrew from a couple of agreements with the Russians, and now both the Russians and the U.S. have accelerated their development of ballistic and other missiles, and now Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons, and Germany gave them submarines that can carry a lot of these nuclear weapons, and probably most of the Israeli arsenal of nuclear and hydrogen bombs are on submarines, not even land-based. So they're running around the Mediterranean Sea and other places. And you can imagine the dangers that we face as a species. There's even, you know, things like this, these intrusive. Everything that we do, by the way, is now recorded. And I'm sure every word that I'm saying here is being recorded in Tel Aviv as we speak, in real time, you know. So that's the way the technology is now available to these countries to do whatever they want to do. But science is a very interesting thing. And when, you know, I have this picture on my desk of Gandhi looking in a microscope. To me, this almost childish curiosity that we all have about the world and nature and what it is that we are doing is very important, and it's very important for our lives and for what we do. And my own contributions to science have been in areas that some of you may not even know about my scientific background, you know, about my other background. But, for example, you know how many chromosomes humans have? 46 chromosomes, right? I was the first scientist to ask why. Why 46? Why not 50? Why not 100? Why not 10? Why 46? Okay, and I answered this with a scientific paper, and I was surprised that nobody has asked that simple question, you know? Or the fact that why, you know, when you have chromosome abnormalities that can lead to spontaneous abortion. Again, the simple question is why? Well, how does a chromosome abnormality lead to spontaneous abortion? I was the first scientist many years ago to answer that question. Or about, you know, the effect of the chromosomes on interface nucleus. Many of you know that, for example, children with Down syndrome have mental retardation and other things. Okay, well, you know, when I asked my professor at the university, you know, who guided my medical training, what does the extra chromosome do to create mental retardation? He said, well, there must be some genes on this chromosome, and you have three copies instead of two copies, so it's a dosage effect. I said, has anybody actually demonstrated it's a dosage effect? And he said, I don't know. Go look it up. So I go look up, and I find that actually there is no genes on chromosome 21 that has to do with mental retardation. And I started investigating, and I found that it has to do with the way the nucleus is structured and the way an extra chromosome kind of interferes in other genes and other chromosomes. So, you know, things like that, I think the curiosity about the world is also what led me to ask the simple question, is what the hell do the Zionists want in Palestine? Well, why did they come to begin with, you know? So I start looking into those things, or the environmental effect of colonialism. So the simple questions sometimes lead you to interesting phenomena. And our current research in the institute that you heard about, Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability, is focused on many, many areas, but they all basically challenge students and challenge others to simply ask questions about the world around them and try to solve problems around them. What do we have to do, and how do we have to challenge this, and what can we do? And one of the brilliant people I heard at this conference, for example, his name is Tariq Othman, he showed how, you know, they were trying to solve the problem of lack of medical equipment in Gaza, and so they were, you know, constructing things, including stethoscopes that normally cost whatever, $100, $200, make it costing $2 from plastic pipes and things like that. And I thought it was brilliant. Same thing, it's a curiosity about the world and curiosity about solving our problems. Now, what's the outcome of this? Why do we want to do this? Why do we want to solve these problems, you know? And I think the answer is obvious, because we are human beings and we need to live in this world, and we need to live in it in some form of sustainable way and not kill each other. And I think that's rational and logical. And sometimes this is the biggest problem that I face, by the way, is trying to understand the logic of the human psyche that makes people go kill each other or drop a bomb, a one-ton bomb on a refugee camp or use a nuclear weapon. To me, that's the part that's most difficult, is to understand the human... I can understand the human motivation for doing good. I could never really understand the human motivation for destruction. That, to me, is the biggest puzzle of all. If I can solve it, then I really deserve a Nobel Prize, okay? Because it's really amazing, you know, how people can just be so callous that they can sit there and with the button, just push a button and obliterate a whole neighborhood. To me, that just is, you know, I could never fathom this kind of motivation. Our research in Palestine is very limited. This is a paper I published in 2012 about the status of research and development in Palestine. And you can see, you know, from, for example, expenditure on research and development as a percent of GDP, we are 0.04%. We spend, by the way, the Palestinian Authority spends 43% of GDP on security. security for the state of Israel, of course, not security for us. Nobody is providing security for us living there. Now, what, you know, this talk, I want to just talk a little bit about where we go as a species, but with a focus on Palestine as a window, perhaps, an opening into this universe of global change. And Palestine has always been a window in some sense or another, because also the first agriculture happened in our region in the Fertile Crescent. As you know, humans developed, they went from hunter-gatherers to agricultural community in our country, which is also, I tell my students, you should be inspired by this, because that's also related to the kind of questions people ask. It must have been some lady that's cooking and throwing seeds. Some seeds fell down, and she was curious, well, if the seeds fell down and they grew these plants, why not, instead of just going collecting the seeds, why not plant the seeds and see? So the first wheat, evidence of wheat agriculture happened near a village called Shukba, in near Tulkarem, in a wadi valley called Natuf, Wadi Natuf. And I went to this cave, remarkable cave. There is still some evidence of a human habitation of it 12,000 years ago, which the first archaeological evidence of domestication of wheat, which gives us the bread that we just had, happened right there in that cave. That's the first archaeological evidence of that historic event in humanity, which is a creative, innovative, scientific, if you want, before the science was invented as a word, event where they, that whoever was in that cave discovered that you can plant wheat. This, to me, is a window that opened up the whole world to agricultural practices, which are now everywhere in the world, of course, and that provide our food. Most of our food is now from agriculture. These people, and I sometimes imagine this woman who discovered this accidentally, that she could grow wheat and barley, must have been no different than this woman, for example, a Palestinian woman of 100 years ago. Just a woman who's trying to take care of her family, trying to care, you know, again, sustainability. It is not, and to me, the difference between this woman, for example, and the first person who, after inventing a spear to kill animals, he thought, maybe I can use the spear to kill a human being and steal his food. To me, that psychology is also innovative in some sense, one can argue, in the same way that you can use, the nuclear medicine for medicine, you can use also nuclear for bombing people. It's where you direct your energy of innovation or creation, if you want. This is a picture of my great-grandmother, by the way, walking down the steps of the old house in Beit Sahur. It's the only picture I have of my great-grandmother, and one of those kids here on the right is my grandfather. Innovation can also be literary innovation. For example, we Palestinians and the Canaanites in general invented something called the alphabet, which you guys use now, the ABCs. The A is from Aleph, which is a bull. That's why it's shaped like that. The B is from Beit, which is a house. The C is, the K is from Kaf, and so on. Palestine is also a window to the world, even today, for birds, for example. Birds of Europe and Asia migrate through Palestine to go to Africa, right? Now, birds are not, to my knowledge, very innovative, but perhaps they are. When one thinks of how they could navigate thousands of miles, using magnetic fields and stars and all this stuff that scientists are now discovering about migration of birds and butterflies and things like that, and dolphins and whales and tortoises and so forth. A lot of innovation. Now, this doesn't take innovation to do this, by the way. This is very simple math of Brutal, who you told me was behind this visualizing Palestine. Yeah. So visualizing Palestine is a website that's remarkable in using graphics to describe what's going on the ground. So, for example, here's between 1967 and today, the destruction of Palestinian buildings and the built-up of Israeli buildings in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And that's what you see, basically, is a visual effect of ethnic displacement. Or this graph, for example, which is how one population is replacing another, 1922 to 1947, 1948 to 1966, and then 1967 to 2018. Graphs are very, and maps and so forth, are very interesting and innovative ways that we can represent ideas, and we should use more of them, in my humble opinion. For example, this, my own calculations and is that what's left for us Palestinians in Palestine, sorry again about the focus here, but what's left for us is in small islands constitute about 8.3% of the historic land of Palestine. 91.7% is reserved for Jewish-only colonies built on stolen Palestinian land. In South Africa, under apartheid, the percentage was 11.5% for the black people, and the rest was reserved for the white people of South Africa. And that percentage, of course, continues to shrink, as it happened in the U.S. until the Native Americans were kept in reservations, basically. And perhaps we are now in reservations, or we will very soon be completely in reservations as Palestinians. This is another graph from visualizing Palestine that shows the growth of the Zionist colonization of Palestine. In blue is the Zionist colonies. Please be careful with the language. I don't speak about Jewish population in Palestine. There were native Jews who were living in Safed and in Hebron and in Jerusalem. Those are not Zionist colonies. There are Jewish communities within Palestine, just like there's Christian communities and Muslim communities. Jewish population in Palestine in 1882 was about 3% of the population, and they were considered like my family, Palestinian Christian family or Muslim families. They were part of the landscape. But the Zionist colonization is different. It's the idea of replacing us and the idea of creating of a Jewish state. And you can see the effect of this as today most of the land is bluish, if you want, and what's left for us, the gray areas, are very limited. Settler colonialism is what it's called. Now, again, if I speak about it in terms of the terminology that I want to just experiment with, this is the first lecture, by the way, I give like this, is the idea of innovation. Colonialists always think of themselves as innovators. Hence, they use terminologies like pioneers, for example, right? They're pioneering ideas. They're bringing technology. They're bringing, as you can see here, modern, railroads, modern knowledge, new ideas, new concepts to a backward country that didn't have these things. So that's what they call innovation. Now, again, I don't want to use terminology good, bad, or evil, but certainly from the perspective of the natives, this was not a good thing for them. And the Native Americans, for example, or Native Palestinians, certainly considered themselves innovative enough that they were able to survive in this land, adapt to it. And this brings me the issue of adaptation. As a biologist, I believe in, of course, biological evolution, adaptation as a phenomena that's very clear. And And I was thinking about this. I'm writing an article about this now, in terms of how Native Indigenous people have evolved over the years to fit the environment that they live in. Those of you who are Palestinians know, for example, or backgrounds and whatever, of if you come from a particular area, your whole biology is adapted to that atmosphere, to that food, to even the microbes in the environment, you're adapted to that, you feel at home. That's why there's something called travel sickness, by the way, when people go other countries, they get sick. Because they are not adapted to that environment. For me, as a Palestinian, for example, when I was living in the U.S., I was trying to create that environment artificially by having Zeytan Za'atar in the house, eating hummus and khubiz, things like that, and even trying to plant some mint and sage and other things around my house, plants from Palestine. You know, I tried to grow the fakus that my family grew in Beit Sahur, which is a small kind of cucumber. Unfortunately, it didn't do well, not in Connecticut, not in North Carolina, not in Texas, where I lived, because it's a plant of that country, so it's hard to grow in any other country. So this is what I call adapting to our environment, and we, as native Palestinians, you know, my ancestors of thousands of years, over these thousands of years, they adapted to the structure of the environment, the use of the plants, the olives, the figs, the almonds, the hawthorn, you know, the carobs. Our biology becomes dependent on it. Our health becomes dependent on it. And you find people much healthier in their own environment than when they are transported elsewhere. And part of the reason why also you see more health issues in city dwellers versus village dwellers is precisely about that, because the city environment is an artificial environment. Food is trucked in from everywhere, and it is not quite the mixture that you need for your stomach and, you know, biotic flora. By the way, each one of us carries about 2 pounds worth of bacteria in our body. You know that, right? Which is very healthy, by the way. It's very important for you, for your digestive system, etc. So, anyways, my point about this is that our bodies evolve slowly. When we are creative, we have to be very, very careful in our creativity. If we are not careful, we can destroy things. You know the story about the rabbits in Australia? The Australians brought some rabbits, and the rabbits got released, and of course they damaged the environment. They said, well, let's find a solution for this. Quick solution. What's a quick solution? The dingo dog. Let's import some dingo dogs. So the dingo dogs were imported into Australia, and the dingo dogs to eat the stupid rabbits that are running amok. And dingo dogs went around, they ate a few rabbits, but then they tasted the other animals around, and they thought, well, those other animals, like some of the endangered Australian fauna, tastes better. So why focus on the rabbits when I can get those slower koalas and whatever? And so they end up doing more damage. So what we have to be very, very careful and humble as human beings in our interventions in our environment, right? We should respect and the museum. Those of you who visited us know that our motto at the museum is respect. First, we respect ourselves as Palestinians, for example, or as any human beings. You respect yourself, that you believe in your power, that's empowerment. You can change your own circumstance. Second is respect for fellow human beings. This doesn't sound too difficult. And third, of course, respect for the environment. This doesn't sound too difficult or too ingenious or whatever in development. But it's really, really very difficult, I can tell you. Because what does it mean, for example, when you respect another human being? How do you respect another human? What is the space you give them? How much how do you deal with them? How do you develop collaboration? What if their ideas are totally different from yours? Sometimes I see radicalism both on the right and in the left in the U.S., for example, because we don't respect sometimes there's political differences, and so we tend to be my way or the highway. Among the left groups in the U.S., when I was last in Connecticut, for example, we had, I don't know, maybe 15 different leftist organizations. They all had similar ideas, but they were like, you know, they want to kill each other. And it's, you know, to me, that's, you know, you have to be very careful. Okay, I have some ideas, but I also have to be humble enough to realize that maybe my ideas are not the perfect ideas. Maybe somebody else's ideas are more perfect than mine. One time, actually, New York Times reporter asked me, and he never published this, but he asked me a question. He said, "Well, so you think Zionism is bad and you guys are right. Well, have you ever considered that you might be wrong?" This is his question. I said, "Of course. I'm a scientist. You know, in science, we believe in the two, according to Karl Popper, the definition of science is, has to be one, falsifiable, and second is repeatable." Falsifiable means that you can prove it wrong. Well, if something is 100% sure, you cannot prove it wrong, so it's not science. So science, by definition, means that you are not 100% sure about anything. Based on the weight of evidence that we have so far, I told him, Zionism is doing a lot of harm, and it's racism and colonialism and all of this. That's a weight of evidence. In the same way that we think the Earth is spherical, and we know about gravity, and we know about time and space and all of this, that's all science. And the theory of evolution, it's all science. But doesn't mean that it's 100% and that it could never be challenged or tested. Certainly, the Earth is spherical, based on our knowledge now, but I'm sure if somebody could make more accurate measurements and later prove to us, as scientists, that the Earth is indeed not quite spherical, maybe it's slightly egg-shaped, oval structure is not quite right. Well, if the weight of evidence comes to prove that, what can I say? As a scientist, I have to accept it. So that's a little bit of humility that we each, I think, need to take into our consideration, our lives. But based on the evidence, you can say, okay, this is settler colonialism that we have, and that settler colonialism in Palestine, like all settler colonialism, has one of three possible outcomes. Either the Algerian model, where the French left Algeria, or the genocide model like in the USA and Australia, or the model of the rest of the world where they live together in one country. I don't say in peace and harmony because there's no kumbaya, you know. in the world there's always problems, but at least that's the scenarios that you have. Which scenario do you prefer? Again, you know, if you're humble enough and you want to be objective, you can say, well, scenario three is the logical scenario. It's the least bloody one, and it's also the most common one based on historical evidence or probability alone. That's where it's going to happen. You see, that's how I reflect on the world in a more objective, scientific way. And maybe I shouldn't use the word objective because objective also is partially subjective in some level. But again, based on the weight of evidence that we have so far, that's what you aim for. And that, in some way, is science. We all are scientists, by the way. Everybody, I tell them, even children, 4 or 5 years old, I tell them, you're scientists. because we all use that logic, that inherent logic that's in our mind. And if you want to fix a faucet in your house, you go about it in a scientific way. You don't just go about it by praying to the faucet or something, or by imagining a better faucet. You think, okay, which plumbers I know, maybe I call my friend, ask him, does he know a good plumber? Whatever. I mean, you try to gather information. That's scientific data gathering, if you want, before you solve it. So, in my opinion, we all do this at some level. And I think, perhaps, if we in the... Let me put it this way. And I said this, I think, last time I was here. I said humanity has two choices now. And we are really, really have to make those choices right now. And the longer we delay, the likelihood of us having that second choice will not be there anymore. The first choice is to just keep going merrily, going around in our happy ways of consumerism, capitalism, buying and using plastic and using fossil fuels as much as we want, and letting the idiots like Trump and Netanyahu and Abu Mazen's run the world. and they will lead us to a nuclear war and perhaps other catastrophes. That's one road, which is, I think most of us would agree, that's not a good road to continue down. Or we can take another road. And that requires literally getting off the road. Or as Howard Zinn put it in one of his books, the title of one of his books is, you can't be neutral in moving train. You've got to get off this train, okay? You can't be neutral in it. It's moving, it's going, it's taking you. It's like the lemmings. You know, they're all running to the cliff. And if you are a lemming sitting there, like some of us, saying to the others, can you just slow down for a minute and let's just think about where we are heading? And the rest of the lemmings say, what, are you crazy? Everybody's going there. Come on, move it. You're in my way. So anyways, that's one road. Or the other road is to actually halt this and go down another road. What's this other road? This is the part that I think is not so obvious to many people. And that's why I think, you know, having 20/20 vision is nice, but most of us have, you know, obviously, I don't have it, so... So what can I do? Is I can try my best to figure out what is it that I should be doing in the 2020s as Mazen, as an individual, that will change something around me or will help somebody change something around me. And to envision a better future and work for it, right? This is what we all do at some level, and I don't, you know, presuppose that any one of us has clearer vision about how to do it than other people. So I hope in the Q&A we can also kind of reflect on this and you can give me your thoughts. And if I write them down, I'll give you credit for them if you want credit. But what is it that we want? What is the future that we as human beings want? Okay, some of us, I'm old, I'm 62 years old. I may not live another 10 years or whatever, and the world begun. But my children, and hopefully grandchildren, if I ever could convince my son to get his act together, he's 34 years old. But anyways, what is it that the future will be like for that generation? What should we be doing of our generation and of that generation? What should we be doing? What are we after? And I think, you know, here, us activists spend very little time reflecting. Most of the time we're reacting, we're demonstrating, we're objecting, we're, like now we're going to have a campaign for Jeopardy to to apologize. Okay, that's nice and good, but that's a reaction. We haven't envisioned what is it that we are going to do 50 years down the road or 100 years down the road. And I think we need to start doing much more of this reflection and taking time away from activism and reflect. And I reflect in... We have a garden, by the way, around the museum, about 12 dunams, about 3 or 4 acres. And I am working usually 16, 17 hours a day in the museum. And seven days a week, all year I'm working there. But it doesn't mean I'm always just doing things like that. I take time out and I go in the garden and I sit down at the pool, for example, and I try to reflect. Or at night I watch the bats flying around the pool, and sometimes I hear an owl or I see a fox running in the garden, and I start to think, what is it that I want this place and the whole world to be like 50 years down the road or 20 years down the road, and how am I contributing towards that vision if I really believe in that vision? And by coincidence, last year, about a year ago, somebody asked me to write an article, not an article, a short story, like a science fiction story about the future of Palestine in 2048. That we're compiling a book about this vision for 2048. So I wrote this thing, and I'm happy to share it with you because I ended up deciding they don't have enough money to publish. So, but I have it, and I think I'll publish it somewhere. I'll find a publication for it. And it's an interesting because it forced me to actually reflect and put characters and people. And I imagined, okay, 2048 from now is only 28 years. So some of the young people who came and volunteered at the museum, certainly will be in their 50s or 40s, so they could be still around. And so I built characters around some of our current young volunteers coming back to the museum in 2048 and seeing life in Palestine, how it is like. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I decided to spin it in the way that we actually, that all of humanity decided to take that second road, and that this happened very quickly around 2020. That very quickly around 2020 there was a global revolution, a global uprising. I called it the Global Intifada. And this Global Intifada in 2020 changed everything. Okay? And so everything changed. Educational systems changed. University education all changed. Universities now teach, they take young people who are brilliant and they make them into good consumers of information and consumers of products. But I said this revolution in 2020 actually changed everything, just toppled the whole system. Borders were removed, and it started, this whole revolution started spreading around the Mediterranean first and then spread to the rest of the world. And the reason I chose to make it start around the Mediterranean is because I thought, well, history, most of it is centered around the Mediterranean. You know, the Roman Empire, the decline of the Roman Empire. First World War started around the Mediterranean, ended around the Mediterranean. Everything starts around the Mediterranean. So we should think about it starting there and continuing there. And I put this vision for 2048 where we're okay. We're relatively okay. We still have remnants of the pollution and all of this stuff, and we have... But technology helped us resolve some of these issues, and that weapons were completely banned, and there was no nationalism, no national flags, no borders, nothing. This is my dream, like Martin Luther King said, I had a dream. This is my dream, and I put it down in writing. I'm happy to share it with anybody who wants that article. I'll send it to them. Now... I may be, of course, completely wrong. As I said, as even as scientists, we could screw up and we don't know what we are doing. So maybe in 2048, there won't be any humans left to reflect or write anything down. Maybe by that time, the beginning of the roach age of humanity will have started. Because roaches would be resistant to nuclear weapon blasts, so they would proliferate quickly on the remnants of the organic matter that's left, which is our bodies and stuff like that. But who knows? I don't know, you know, again, you know, don't expect me to give you concrete answers. There are some things that are irretrievable. You cannot go backwards in time. You cannot change this colony, the concrete jungle that's down there, to bring it back to be a forest that's right next to my house. It cannot be undone. So there are certain things cannot be undone. So, and we have to live with it. And perhaps that's not a bad thing, that we have to literally see our effects continuing and not be able to reclaim all of our planet. But certainly we can reclaim a lot of things. You know, there are certain things that we can challenge and we can fix. Climate change is coming at us with a vengeance, as you know, around the world. And there are many environmental effects, and the growth of the human population we have to deal with, the destruction of the agricultural biodiversity, agrobiodiversity, destruction of the coral reef systems, destruction of most of our life forms on Earth. Maybe it's now irretrievable, some of this. You have seen the fires in Australia, for example. This is the latest image I got down of the forest fire danger index, and mostly in the east and south of Australia. The United Nations actually described that basically the poor countries, the developing countries, will suffer most from the effect of climate change. Now, as PIBS, Palestine Institute of Biodiversity and Sustainability, as I told you, our vision, if you want, is sustainable human and biodiversity. Sustainable human and natural communities, if you want. And diversity maybe is a key to envisioning a better future for all of us. And maybe we should just start spreading the word that all of us should recoil at any attempt to reduce diversity anywhere on Earth, whether it's human diversity or biodiversity or agricultural diversity or any of this stuff. Diversity is perhaps a key to this future. This is Palestine 1932, for example, religious and secular leaders getting together to protest Zionism, protest colonialism. They include people of various religions and persuasions, including a rabbi and a Samaritan priest, etc. To work on these things, to promote diversity and challenge climate change, is far more difficult than I had anticipated. Not because of the technological aspects. I think technology and knowledge and science is very powerful, can help us in a lot of ways. But mostly it has to do with changing human minds. And human minds, changing human minds. One recent scientist who used to work on ecology and ecosystems and finally gave up, he said, they teach us everything in biology, but they don't teach us how to change human minds. And that's the difficulty of continuing to do conservation work, so he quit. I haven't quit yet. I try. For example, on climate change, we developed, with the help of some Swiss people, I'm going to Switzerland next week to meet with them and with other colleagues in Switzerland, we developed basically culturally sensitive and posters and educational materials for climate change, which you can see some of them here. I have some of them also in my bag if anybody wants a full set. And working with young children to work on these things, I actually became very optimistic because I saw that they have the motivation, they have the ability to change their own behavior, and that they were brilliant in coming up with innovative solutions even when they are very young. When they are 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old, they could come up with solutions that I couldn't even anticipate or figure that they could come out with. And so I became more optimistic about this, more hopeful, I should say, not quite fully optimistic about the future, but at least hopeful that indeed we can do something, even in difficult situations like colonization, occupation. We started getting some projects since I spoke to you about 2.5 years ago. We got, for example, grant from National Geographic and from the Darwin Initiative for working with villagers in the Makhrur area of Bethlehem, four areas, Batir, Hussan, Al-Walaja, and Beit Jala. We have 80 farmers that we are working with to provide food security for them and their economy, and also to help them learn about the ecosystems and not use pesticides, insecticides, things like that. We discovered significant diversity in this valley that's shared by those four villages, including over 400 species of plants, including endangered orchids, etc. We studied the insects. We studied many things in those areas. And we got a grant from the British Council, and this grant was completed successfully. It was a grant to preserve cultural and heritage, whether tangible or intangible, associated with agriculture and associated with nature, and use this cultural heritage to promote environmental conservation and sustainability. The grant was for about £90,000, about $100,000 or so. It was so successful. We created websites. We created even a mobile application for children to play in called Sidul Muzari, which means grandfather, the farmer. They can play and at the same time learn about agriculture and nature and stuff like that. It was so successful that the British Council actually came back to me and said, "We're amazed at how much you could do for £90,000. And now we want you to write us something bigger, like £250,000 or £300,000. So I said, "Sure." So I think that's, this is the opening of the cultural heritage exhibit. We also did some training for our tour guides, so that they can start teaching about cultural heritage related to nature and agriculture. We have many other projects that relate to biodiversity and education and environmental awareness, etc. And we get a lot of international volunteers. And as you heard, you're welcome to come and volunteer with us. We always have fun and seasonal funds on different things. For example, here, we're harvesting the apricots and we're making apricot jam in our house with some international volunteers. Actually, one of the ladies here, that's Zohar, she's Israeli. She spent 6 months with us. She was an organizer of the boat to Gaza, by the way, to break the siege on Gaza. She recruited me to be on the boat, and at the boat I talked to her, told her about what we are doing. And she chose to come and volunteer with us, and I'm going to see her in Connecticut on the trip. These are just some of our people who also travel abroad, like this is Mohammed Najajra and Rina in Switzerland with our Swiss partners who worked on the climate change project. We created more recently, and I'm very proud to tell you this, we created a movement called Palestine Action for the Planet. And people told us we must be crazy, you know, we're under colonization, occupation, the whole planet doesn't care about us, why should we care about the planet? And I told them, no, we're all part of this system. And if we don't get our act together, no matter where we are, what our circumstances is, we need to. So we are in partnership with Extinction Rebellion, if you know the movement. And we're trying to do something locally on things like reusing, recycling, etc. This is a small, card that we passed around at events. We have successes, I would say, in certain areas, partly because we're not even thinking outside the box. We're imagining there's no box. Maybe we are delusional, but we try at least. And I get students to be working on the areas that are, again, you see the word innovate, innovation in the best possible use of a term, not innovation, again, of being destructive or anything else. That's what we do. And this is the shape of the museum. I showed this picture, I think, to you about 2.5 years ago.
You have been listening to Palestinian scientist and activist Mazen Kumsia. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.